Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The following podcast contains adult content, explicit language, and sexual themes. Listener discretion is advised. And it contains murder. Lots and lots of murder.
You stinking bastard.
People tell me, hey, you're gonna go die and go to hell. At least I'm not alone.
Down for 911, where's your emergency?
Oh, this is Sandy. For 41, look.
What's the problem?
Send the police!
Hey guys, don't be a hero, mate. And I said, I'm not trying to be a hero, but the police are coming.
One in the chest, one in the hip. Fired by Detective Sergeant Roger Rogerson.
I was branching out. That's when the cannibalism started. Eating of the heart and the arm muscle.
Oh, I would have nailed Carl Williams' hands to a coffee table and just pulled it out of his backside. Carl Williams is a wobbly bottom little... Cherub face little boy whose life
would be. I'd harm someone anytime. I'd kill someone. There'd be an enormous amount of, especially at first, enormous amount of horror, guilt, remorse afterwards. But then that impulse to do it again would come back even stronger.
Caesar Baroni, a.k.a. Adolph James Roney, was an American serial killer and sexual sadist whose preferred victims were elderly women. Not one to limit himself, he'd also rape and murder younger women when the mood struck him.
Like most serial killers, he led a double life, and those close to him had no idea what he was getting up to. He also had the dubious honour of being prison pals with Ted Bundy. Welcome to part one of our two-part special on Bundy's buddy, serial killer Caesar Baroni. Hi, I'm Barney Black.
And I'm Tara Saraband.
And this is Bloody Murder.
We're a comedy true crime podcast focusing on some of the lesser-known crime stories from Australia.
And indeed around the globe.
Now, as a comedy true crime podcast, we use humour to lighten up horrifying stories, but never at the expense of the victims or their loved ones.
If you think comedy has no business being associated with tragedy, then Bloody Murder may not be the podcast for you.
Now, before we commence our sordid tales, we'd like to remind you that this episode is brought to you by our wonderful and generous patrons.
We've had quite a few new ones join our new fancy Patreon program, which we will thank individually after our story.
If you'd like to become a patron, go to our website for details. That's bloodymurderpodcast.com.
As a patron, you have access to dozens of other episodes, including our Don't Threaten Us With a Good Time first season and ad-free versions of all of our regular episodes.
As well as exclusive patron-only monthly episodes where we put our thing down, flip it and reverse it.
And we put our hands in the air and wave them around like we just don't care.
Yeah, there is a lot of dancing, but mostly we just talk about true crime.
Levels above $5 receive stickers and handmade Barney badges. All right, Tara. Let's get murdery.
December 4th, 1960 was not a very auspicious day, aside from being Scottish comedian Ronnie Corbett's 30th birthday. Are You Lonesome Tonight by Elvis Presley was the number one song in the United States, and in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, a heinous sexual predator was born to the Rohde family, joining an older brother Ricky and sister Debbie. They named him Adolph, which was an interesting choice.
It really is an interesting choice. Were they big fans of Hitler?
Not that I'm aware of. He was named after his grandfather, but Hitler's ghost gave him a thumbs up and a wink and thought to himself, cool, this guy's going to bring a lot of misery to the world.
But it was only 15 years after Hitler's death.
Too soon?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's still too soon. Adolph James Roney went by his middle name Jimmy, though he later changed his name to Caesar Baroni. We're going to keep calling him Jimmy for consistency.
Are you sure we shouldn't just bite the bullet and call him Adolph?
Look, I thought about that, but a lot of the quotes used in this piece refer to him as Jimmy, and I was hoping to make this as straightforward as possible.
Well, I think it's just a missed opportunity.
When Jimmy was four, his parents divorced as his mother had run off with another man. She stayed in regular contact with her kids, but they were raised by their carpenter father. He got a girlfriend named Brenda, who he married in 1987. And she helped raise the three roadie children. According to the book Dead of Night by John Lasseter, Brenda noticed young Jimmy had some behavioural problems and recommended to his dad that he go to counselling when he was 5 years old. Unfortunately, his father didn't support this idea. The roadies moved to a better neighbourhood and had a house with a pool. The kids were so into their stepmother Brenda that they asked her not to tell their friends that she wasn't their real mum. Although their father worked long hours, he was keen on spending as much time with his kids as he could. Looking back on their childhood, Brenda said, their father coached football because they wanted to play football. Their father took them hunting. Their father took them fishing. Their father took them camping. Their father took them playing golf. Their father did everything with them for years. Brenda and their dad's relationship was strained by little Jimmy's increasingly aggressive behaviour. Brenda said, it seemed like either the school was calling me, a neighbour was calling me, somehow he was getting in trouble every day for doing things. And every day when his father came home from work, I'd say, you've got to talk to Jimmy. It got to where his father kept thinking I was picking on him. And I tried to explain to his father, I didn't even tell him everything that Jimmy did. I only told him the things I thought were important enough for him to know.
Oh, that Jimmy, he's put his bum in the mashed potato again.
Oh, they would have actually probably given him like a gold star for not stabbing someone in the face or doing other things with his bottom. Jimmy got expelled from kindergarten, which is pretty hard to do, but he was so disruptive they were left with no choice.
Whoa, what did he do? Put his dick in the finger paints?
They wish he only put his dick in the finger paints.
Did he take a shit in a sandpit?
Just one shit? More like a dozen shits. He also got banned from the school lunchroom in grade one for being a nasty little sadist. He graduated to threatening children with knives and trying to put lit cigarettes out on their eyeballs.
Oh, Jimmy, little Lucy's eyes aren't ashtrays.
He started fights, shoplifted, and stole money from his parents. Whenever Brenda tried to confront him over what he did, he'd deny that he'd done anything wrong.
When Jimmy was 12, Brenda divorced his father as they were having problems and she couldn't handle the constant stress of dealing with Jimmy's violent behaviour anymore. Now Brenda was gone and with his father still working long hours, there was nobody around to keep an eye on Jimmy, so he stepped up his villainous ways. When he became a teenager, Jimmy grew his hair long, smoked weed, shoplifted, took LSD and quaaludes, and started a lifelong obsession with breaking into elderly women's houses. He and his friends would raid trailer homes of elderly neighbours and steal alcohol and money. By this point, Jimmy's hand felt naked without a beer in it.
He was getting on the piss a lot.
Yes, yes he was, and he continued to do so. Now, this is a funny fact about Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
He loved reptiles, possibly because their cold-bloodedness reminded him of himself.
Oh, come on. Comparing this guy to reptiles is a bit harsh. On the reptiles.
That's true. Sorry, reptiles. R.I.P. Brenda Lizard.
Lest we forget.
He'd bring snakes and alligators home from nearby swamps and put them in the swimming pool in his backyard.
Did he go for a swim with them?
Well, he tried to, Tara, but the alligators and snakes found him so repulsive they scampered back into the swamps, shuddering in disgust.
That would be my response to a pool party with Jimmy too.
According to the book Dead of Night by John Lasseter, Jimmy somehow got his hands on a sick monkey and nursed it back to health. Because there's lots of roaming sick monkeys.
Florida.
In Florida. Mm. I'm pretty sure that's true.
I like to think that he started lactating and became its wet nurse.
But it wasn't milk he fed it.
Please tell me it was bananas.
No.
Muesli?
No. It wasn't sausages or pancakes too.
Ugh.
I wish. He fed his pet monkey live cats.
Ah.
He'd chuck a cat in the cage with the monkey and, well...
Yeah, Travis the chimp nearly killed a woman and ate her face, so...
Yeah, he said he liked to watch the monkey tear the cats apart. Now, that's the last of the animal cruelty in this case, by the way. I just thought I should let you all know.
There's plenty of cruelty to people, though.
Ain't that the truth?
Did you know his pet monkey was named Adolf Jr.?
No.
It's not true. I just made it up.
It's called Tara.
It was called Barney, but better. As he got older, Jimmy did not grow out of his habit of breaking into the homes of elderly women. Quite the opposite. A detective suspected him in an alarming home invasion where he cut the phone lines of a 70-year-old widow's house, then broke in while she was asleep. He stole some money, then masturbated and urinated inside her home. Unfortunately, there was not enough evidence to put him away for this, as it was the 1970s. Jimmy was referred to a lot in the research we did as being good-looking, but so is Ted Bundy, so fuck that. He was about 5'10", with a medium build and short brown hair, with highlights on the top.
Oh lordy, he had frosted tips?
At certain times, yes, but that's actually probably the best thing about him. 70-year-old retired schoolteacher Alice Stock lived in the same neighbourhood as Jimmy. She had been a teacher of children with learning difficulties. Her neighbour, Iris Linton, described Alice as a very caring and understanding person. The type of work she'd been involved in made her even more understanding. When Iris had broken her arm, Alice would make meals for her and come over to help her with household chores. Soon after dark, on October 5th, 1975, Alice phoned her neighbour Iris, who said, "She was quite agitated and upset. I was very concerned about her because of her hypertension and other problems she had, and she asked me to come over to her house. Something had happened." When Iris got there, Alice was panicked and shaking. When Iris asked her what happened, Alice told her that Jimmy had broken into her house and that he'd threatened her with a knife and asked her to take off all her clothes. Alice, who was described as a very prim and proper lady, flatly refused. Realising she was adamant about that, he backed out of her house and scampered off. Iris advised her distraught friend to call the police. As they waited for them to arrive, Alice showed Iris a screen that had been removed from a back window, which is where Jimmy had gained entry. 15-year-old Adolf Jimmy Rohde was arrested. He spent 2 months and 11 days in juvie, but it didn't seem to deter the boy from his chosen path of vileness.
In April 1977, Detective Robert Williams of the Fort Lauderdale PD, Juvenile Section, arrested Jimmy on suspicion of burglarising a residence a block from Alice Stock's house. When questioning Jimmy, he said he'd gone to the house with two friends and waited outside as they broke in. He said all he did was be their lookout. What he didn't know is that his two friends had already been questioned by police and had implicated him. Detective Williams figured since he had a hold of Jimmy, he may as well ask him about other thefts in the area too. The detective agreed not to press charges against him if he was honest.
Which is...
that's how police work, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't think it was, but that's what we read.
Jimmy admitted to breaking into another elderly woman's house and stealing money. This woman lived in the same block as Alice too.
He's a lazy bloody bugger, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Jimmy said he gained entry by cutting open a window screen. He also came clean about another robbery of an elderly woman's house. This time he stole some books.
Do you know what books he stole?
Terrorising Old Ladies for Dummies.
It's weird that she owned that.
Jimmy was given a warning that he might face serious charges next time. Next time. He admitted to three burglaries and nothing happened.
I mean, that's not exactly true. The police made him give the books back.
Well, do you think that served as a deterrent, though?
I know it didn't.
Less than 5 months later, on August 23rd, Jimmy was arrested on suspicion of burglary. Again. He was questioned and released.
Again.
Again. Like a fish that you catch. You give it a kiss and you throw it back in.
Yeah, it was too small. They just went, bump, maybe later, friend.
Splash. A day later, Detective Robert Williams went to his house and arrested him for yet another break-in, this time at the Sunset Trailer Park, one block away from his house. God, he's lazy.
I know.
This time he'd left his fingerprints at the crime scene.
He probably figured it didn't matter what he did. There would never be any consequences.
Then he drank beer with his pet monkey and laughed.
Yeah, he and Adolf Jr. both laughed.
After his arrest, Jimmy lawyered up. Detective Williams tried instead to get him to admit to other burglaries, saying if there was no violence involved, he wouldn't charge him. Jimmy eventually copped to 9 more burglaries. Detective Williams drove Jimmy around the neighbourhood so he could point out the houses he'd broken into.
It might have been quicker for him to point out the houses he hadn't broken into.
I'd agree with that. Now, for reasons we couldn't comprehend, Jimmy was only charged with the Sunset Trailer Park break-in and found guilty of one count of burglary. He had just turned 17 and was sentenced to 3 years in the Florida State Penitentiary and ordered to pay a whopping $130 in restitution to the victim. He would have been sent to juvie again in a lot of other states, but Florida wasn't playing.
We appreciate your effort, Florida.
Jimmy was transported to the Indian River Correctional Institution north of Fort Lauderdale. It was a low-security institution for first-time non-violent offenders who were under 24 and sentenced to under 10 years.
But it's so far away from being his first offence.
I know, it's very frustrating.
Yeah, we can't even see his first offence from here.
Due to his apparent good behaviour, he was transferred to Pompano Community Correction Centre in January 1979. It was a minimum security facility with no fences or armed guards. So kind of like a hotel.
Yeah, or a park.
Jimmy worked as a day labourer in the local community. That was until he went AWOL from his job and was put into administrative confinement in February 79. In March, he was booted from the work program for his absence and reports of money being stolen from his employer. At a violation hearing, it was decided to send him back to Indian River to serve out the rest of his sentence. Out off, Jimmy Rohde was released back into society on November 13, 1979.
Nobody informed his neighbour, Alice Stock, who he'd attempted to rape at knife point, that Jimmy was back in the neighbourhood. She was still living alone in the house he'd broken into and terrorised her in 3 years earlier. 73-year-old Alice had suffered a minor heart attack and a stroke in this time, but was still able to get around and look after herself while living alone.
Oh, she's a sprightly old bird. I like her.
Yeah, she's cool. At 6:30 a.m. on November 29th, Patrol Officer Michael Wiley received a call telling him to head to the 400 block of Southwest 25th Terrace as someone was injured or maybe dead. When he arrived a few minutes later, one of Alice's neighbours, who'd called the police, took him into the back bedroom of Alice's house. A sheet covered the body lying on the bed. The officer pulled it back to find Alice Stock's naked body. She'd been raped and strangled. A later autopsy revealed petechial hemorrhages in her eyes, bruises on her neck, as well as a crushed windpipe and larynx. Alex's cause of death was asphyxia due to manual strangulation. No seminal fluid was found, but hairs were discovered on Alice's body that weren't hers. Circumstantial evidence pointed directly at Jimmy. After calling the homicide squad, Officer Wiley searched the house and yard. Outside, he noticed some footprints in the sand under Alice's bedroom window. It was soft sand, so only partial prints could be gained from making casts. The house was dusted for prints and a cast was made of the footprint. There were no signs anything had been stolen. Alice's purse hadn't even been cleaned out. Detective Philip J. Mundy took over the investigation. He was a former New York detective before moving to Florida. After speaking to friends and neighbours, detectives learned about the incident 3 years earlier where Jimmy had broken into Alice's home. When Mundy checked Jimmy's rap sheet, he was alarmed to find he'd been paroled only 2 weeks earlier. The Rohdes moved to a property 2 miles away from their old place. Detectives went to his house to question Jimmy. He claimed he'd had an alibi for that night, as he'd been at the Bristol pub until 11:15 p.m. Mundy thought the soles of the shoes he was wearing resembled the prints at Alice's place, so he took them back to the station with him. Detectives told Jimmy not to leave town and went to check his alibi at the Bristol pub. This is when they discovered that the pub was less than 10 minutes' walk from Alice's house. The shoe pattern they found at the crime scene didn't have any individual characteristics that were big enough to leave a mark in the semi-loose sand, so it was impossible to match them with Jimmy's shoes. It was found that the left shoe was consistent with the plaster cast, but nobody could say for sure that it was that particular left shoe. They could say it was a left shoe of that type, with that same pattern in it, but not exactly that one. Detective Mundy took all the evidence that had been collected to the prosecutor's office, but they didn't think it would be enough to convict Jimmy.
3 days after Christmas that year, Jimmy's older brother Ricky died in a car crash. Ricky, by all accounts, was a stand-up guy and not a shitheel like Jimmy. A lot of family members at Ricky's funeral thought that it was terribly unfair that Ricky had died instead of Jimmy. Whoa. Their former stepmother, Brenda, even told him as much after the funeral. According to the book Dead of Night by John Lasseter, Brenda blurted out, "If one of you had to get killed, why did it have to be Ricky? He was so good." It's not a nice thing to say to anyone, and normally I think it was too harsh, but in this case, it was true.
If anything, she was being generous.
Oh, yeah. Feeling terrible about it, Brenda gave Jimmy her old Mustang. She was upgrading to a Cadillac and didn't need it anymore. Brenda lived in Hollywood, Florida, not far from where Jimmy was living. In mid-January 1980, a few weeks after Jimmy turned 19, he rocked up on Brenda's doorstep. He told her he was very upset about his brother Ricky's death and needed someone to talk to. Brenda let him in and the two of them sat at her dining room table and talked about Ricky for 20-odd minutes. After Jimmy finished his glass of water and put the empty glass on the sink, he maneuvered himself behind Brenda. Brenda recalls, "I was sitting in a dining room chair. He came up behind me like he was going to lean over and kiss me on the cheek, goodbye or something. He slid one arm underneath my breast and the other arm under my throat and pulled me off the chair backwards." He dragged his father's ex-wife Brenda, the woman who helped raise him, over to the couch and tightened both hands around her neck. Then he wrestled her into the bedroom and raped her. Brenda said, "He told me it was something he had dreamt about for years." After the rape, he started choking her out again. Brenda said, "He told me just to lay there and relax. It wouldn't hurt. It would be just like going to sleep." She thought to herself, "Fuck that," and fought as hard as she could for her life, saying, "I kept pushing and beating on him. I screamed at him that I was his mother. It was like he recognized me and kind of relaxed or something for a minute and stood up. And I think he still had his trousers around his ankles. Somehow I got loose. I got in the bathroom. I laid on the floor and pinned my feet against the door and my head against the tub." Jimmy bashed on the door, yelling for her to open it, but Brenda used her body like a barricade. He eventually gave up and left. Brenda stayed frozen on the bathroom floor for a long time before getting up the nerve to check if he'd gone. Brenda was in shock. She wasn't sure what to do. She worried the police wouldn't believe that her stepson had raped her and would think that she'd led him on. She barricaded herself in the bedroom for the next 3 days. Afterwards, she called Jimmy's dad and met up with him. She told him what had happened and showed him the bruises on her neck. He cut ties with Jimmy. They barely spoke again after this. He was probably pissed off that his good son died and his shit son lived on. Brenda told Jimmy's sister Debbie about the attack, but decided she couldn't face reporting it to the police or potentially going to court.
We'll be back with more of Bundy's buddy, serial killer Cesar Baroni, after this.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What time is it, Barney?
It's True Crime Nerd time.
Hooray! True Crime Nerd time. True Crime Nerd time. True Crime Nerd time.
True Crime Nerd Time is an opportunity for you, our listeners, to give us your recommendations for anything true or fiction crime related. It could be a book, movie, TV series, graphic novel. It could be a pair of jeans that you've cut into shorts that are just criminally, like, hot.
True Crime Jorts Time.
Yeah, I like the sound of that.
I like true crime and when my jorts are on.
Or anything that has scratched your crime-obsessed itch. Are you itchy, Tara? You can record your voice. Just do it on your phone. We'll play it. We'll write it and we'll read it out. And we have one here from Leah Heinrich, and she tells us about the Netflix documentary Filthy Rich Jeffrey Epstein. And she recorded her cuss-laden review, so let's hear it.
Hi, Tara and Barney. I'm bringing you another True Crime Nerd Time because I found it rather fun doing the last one. But I will warn you and the lovely listeners, this one gets a little sweary. I recently binged Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich, on Netflix, and hell am I fucking mad now. I thought I couldn't hate that poor excuse for a man anymore, but now I have a lot more detail on the case, I can safely say that I fucking well do hate that poor excuse for a man even more. In case you've been living under a true crime rock for the past 18 months to 20 years, Epstein, or as I like to call him, Cunty McCumface, is basically the most horrid, detestable rich man that has ever existed, until the next one crawls out from under his entitled rich man enabler blanket of cover. So, C. McCF was a sexual abuser and pedophile who got away with it all due to his wealth and the number of enablers and protectors that have crawled back under their own rocks since his arrest. I found the four-part doco on Netflix fascinating. I couldn't stop watching, but it was coronary-inducing due to the amount of screaming and swearing I did at the television as time after time, C. McCF gets away with his horrendous crimes. He got away with them for years and years before police finally had enough evidence and found a DA who would arrest to try to bring him to justice. But he again, and major spoiler alert here, eluded them by taking his own life. It was so unfair for the victims. The things I liked most about the documentary was that filmmaker Lisa Bryant focuses on some of the more outspoken victims and giving them a strong voice to tell their stories. I also loved the fact that it ended with a "we're not done yet" message, which is fantastic because there are a lot of people in C. McCF's life who were complicit in his crimes. Let's get those fuckers too. Not naming names, but, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell and Prince Andrew, for instance. So I highly recommend Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich, but beware, it really is hard to watch, not only because of the detailed descriptions of the abuse, but also because it's so unbelievable that the prick got away with it for so long. It's simply unfathomable. Anyway, rant over. Thanks for listening.
Well, thanks, Lee. I've got to check that out. That documentary is Filthy Rich Jeffrey Epstein, the details of which will be in the show notes.
Yeah, that was fantastic. I haven't watched all of it yet, but I feel the same way. I think Leah was holding back, to tell you the truth. I think she wanted to drop in a few more C-bombs, quite frankly, because he was a complete and utter cunt.
Well, thanks for sending that in, Leah. And if you want to be cool like Leah, and submit to True Crime Nerd Time, visit our website, bloodymurderpodcast.com, for instructions on how to contribute.
So, it's still 2020, huh?
Yep.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
But I've already had my fill, Tara.
Yeah. Please, sir, I don't want some more. Is everything going on in life and the way this year is panning out interfering with your ability to be happy?
Is something stopping you from achieving your goals?
Are you finding it difficult to just keep on rocking and maintain a positive outlook?
Or perhaps all of this is just making other stuff you have to deal with even harder.
We're both big believers in therapy, and there's no better time than now to take care of your mental health.
BetterHelp is there for you no matter where you are.
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
You can connect in a safe and private online environment.
And you can start communicating in under 24 hours.
It's professional counselling that produces real results, not self-help.
And you can communicate with your counsellor at any time.
You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions.
All without having to sit in a germy, people-y, uncomfortable waiting room.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so they make it easy and free to change counsellors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counselling and financial aid is available.
And it's a service you can access worldwide.
You can be communicating with licensed professional counsellors who have a broad range of expertise and specialise in areas such as family conflicts, LGBTQI matters, stress, relationships and trauma.
And anything you share is, of course, confidential.
It's convenient, professional, and very affordable.
Now, if you want to start living a happier life today, connect with BetterHelp.
And as a Bloody Murder listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting BetterHelp, that's betterhelp.com/bloodymurder.
Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health.
Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them access your needs and get matched with a counsellor that suits you.
If you don't believe us, check out the dozens of positive testimonials on their website.
So visit betterhelp.com/bloodymurder. That's betterhelp.com/bloodymurder.
And now the conclusion of part one of Bundy's buddy, serial killer Cesar Baroni.
Jimmy's biological mother had left the family when he was 4 years old, but she stayed in touch with her kids. A few weeks after raping his stepmother, Jimmy broke the window of a brand new Corvette and stole the valuables inside.
He probably got himself some sweet cassettes.
Yeah, some sweet Milli Vanilli cassettes.
They would have been worth a pretty penny.
Oh, you wouldn't sell them, but...
No.
Several people saw Jimmy break into the car, so he ended up in jail accused of burglary and possession of burglary tools. These were both violations of his parole. He called his mother and told her some sob story, and she coughed up the $200 to bail him out. Thanks to that... According to the book Dead of Night, on April 12th at 9:30 p.m, 70-year-old Matty Marino was found lying on her blood-stained kitchen floor half-conscious, her face marred with purple bruising, eyes swollen and bleeding from the mouth. Her neighbours found her and called the police and paramedics. When she was well enough to answer questions, she said that Jimmy had come over to her place to borrow a spool of white thread. He'd smiled, kissed her on the cheek, and asked to use her phone. Then he turned evil without warning and started punching her before picking up a rolling pin from the kitchen counter and beating her about the head with it. Next, he choked her until she fell down. Then he stole $10 and her checkbook before fleeing the scene. When asked if she knew who her assailant was, Maddie said, of course she did. It was her grandson, Jimmy Rohde. Her daughter was his mother.
Oh, and his mother had just bailed him out.
Yes.
Ugh.
Of the attack, Maddie said, he was smiling at me all the time. All the time he was choking me. Something had to snap in Jimmy because he wouldn't put his hands on me otherwise. Maddie said she'd begged him not to hit her, and when that didn't work, she prayed. Jimmy was charged with attempted murder. In court, Jimmy chose to take the stand. He said he'd gone to his grandmother's place on April 12th, borrowed the thread, and left. His defense attorney pointed out that Maddie's place had been burglarized 10 days earlier, probably by Jimmy, and claimed that the thief had come back to finish the job. They said Maddie was just confused and wouldn't know if it was her grandson beating the crap out of her with a rolling pin or not. Disrespectful as this defence was, it worked and Jimmy was found not guilty. The arrest his mum bailed him out for, breaking into the Corvette, had violated the parole he was under following his release from prison, and Jimmy was sentenced to 5 more years. This time it would be a proper adult prison. He was sent to Baker Correctional Institution near Jacksonville, where he was considered a medium security inmate.
The Florida Parole and Probation Commission set Jimmy a parole date of March 30, 1982. This meant his new conviction was pretty much ignored and he could be out in 2 years if he kept his nose clean. But keeping his nose clean was something Jimmy never thought he needed to do. While out of prison on work detail on July 9th, 1981, he made a break for it. Jailbreaker! He was found a few hours later. 9 days after this, he created a scene about the food he was given not being good enough for him and was written up for disorderly conduct.
These pancakes suck ass!
Well, this pissed him off about the pancakes sucking ass, so he acted out more and was transferred to Sumter Correctional Institute, which specialised in keeping prisoners who had escaped lockup.
Yeah, it was a prisoner for slippery suckers like this guy.
He also had a year added to his sentence. On December 10th, Jimmy was rehoused at the Marion Correctional Institution, where on January 20th, he was disciplined for possession of an unauthorised beverage. I mean toilet wine.
He had 2 gallons of it.
Where did he keep the toilet wine?
In the toilet, obviously.
Then where did he go to the toilet?
Probably in the wine.
Yum.
Mmm.
He continued to go AWOL from work duty, get in fights and just be his usual turd of a self, even making obscene comments and profane gestures to a medical staff member. On October 6, he was sent to Cross City Correctional Institution. He continued to disobey guards and be a total dickhole, and apparently had an oral sex with friends benefits arrangement with his cellmate.
Now, if you've seen a picture of him and his big teeth, you'd know this was a dangerous idea.
Yeah, he has big creepy tombstone teeth.
Yeah.
Let's not think about it.
Mm.
In August 1983, Jimmy assaulted 59-year-old corrections officer Gladys Dean, who worked the afternoon shift overseeing food preparation and cleanup duties. Jimmy was on garbage duty that day, and she overheard him say some hideous and derogatory things about women. This is not surprising.
No, it really isn't.
She was not a big fan of publicly disciplining the inmates, but she decided to speak up. Gladys said to him, "You should be ashamed to talk like that because your mother is a woman." A few days later, on August 23, when they were alone, Jimmy grabbed Gladys around the neck from behind and dragged her into a secluded area. He tried to unbutton her shirt but got frustrated and choked her more. Gladys said, "I was scared, really afraid. I didn't know what he intended to do and I had no time to think. About the time I thought I was going to black out, something told me to do what you've always been told to do if you're caught in a situation. Grab a man where it hurts the worst. And that's what I did. And when I did and twisted down on him, he left and ran out of the room." Jimmy and his sore, sad dick scampered back to his cell and muttered to his friend with benefits, "Oh, I think somebody's going to say I tried to rape her." Well, they would, wouldn't they?
Because you did, didn't you?
In January 84, he was sentenced to 3 extra years for battery of a law enforcement officer.
Can we just call the whole episode Jimmy and his sore, sad dick?
Well, that'd have copyright issues, Tara.
What? Why?
Because that's the name of my fourth album.
Hey, baby. So Jimmy and his sore, sad dick went to prison in 1981 and could have been paroled in 1982, but due to his shitty attitude and violent actions, he was now supposed to be there until 1991.
Well, surely that would teach him a lesson.
Nope. A couple of months later, a search of Jimmy's cell uncovered 2 bits of hacksaw blades he'd hidden. 9 days later, he was transferred to Florida State Prison in Stark, a maximum security prison and the home of old Sparky the electric chair and temporary home of one Theodore Robert Bundy. Jimmy was a big Ted Bundy fangirl. After all, he was super famous and dreamy and had reporters and writers desperate to interview him. As they were housed in the same cell block, Jimmy would see Bundy around sometimes and swoon. He'd also try to start conversations with him.
"Hey, Ted, seen any good movies lately?"
"Hey, Ted, if you could kill one famous woman from history, who would it be and why?"
"Hey, Ted, I got a Kit Kat from the commissary. You want half?"
"Hey, Ted, who's your favourite character from the TV show MASH? You don't watch it?" "Yeah, me either. It's really dumb." One day Bundy had finished reading a Seattle newspaper and he slipped it to Jimmy. Jimmy's greedy little fingers grasped the paper to his chest, hoping it contained a message from his dreamy dream boyfriend, Ted Bundy. Perhaps there was a note in it that asked, "Do you like me?" and had 2 squares drawn below, one marked yes and the other marked no, and he was supposed to tick it and give it back.
Maybe they could get put in the same cell together and give each other blowjobs.
And braid each other's hair.
Better yet, they could rape and kill each other.
"Hey, Bundy, here's a piece of wood. Go for gold."
Hang on a minute. Why are you on Bundy's side?
I'm not on anyone's side, but Bundy gets fried in the electric chair in prison and Jimmy gets let out and kills a lot more people. So in this situation, I am handing Bundy the log.
Yeah, that's fair.
Police spokeswoman Sonia Friedman said, during their conversations, Bundy spoke of mistakes that led to his capture. He was basically a new and improved killer after he spent some time with Bundy. Jimmy asked Bundy questions about how he got caught and ways to avoid detection. Apparently, he thought it was really neat and bragged to other inmates about his friendship with Bundy. Now, the newspaper Bundy gave him had singles ads in it from Washington.
32-year-old Washington resident Kathy Lockhart was hoping to find a partner. She worked for a legal firm and was smart and pretty with a good sense of humour, but was done with the bar scene.
"You and me both, sister."
A friend suggested she take out a singles ad in a newspaper, so she gave it a red-hot go. She received a response from Jimmy from Florida in July 1986. It read, "Hi, how are you doing? I hope this letter finds you in good spirits. I saw your ad in the Weekly. I have never written to anyone before,
but I was feeling kind of lonely today, so I thought I'd write you a few lines. I'm 5'10", 33 years old, and 173 pounds. I have black hair, hazel eyes, and I'm an Italian. I've come from Milan. You see, he was obsessed with gangsters and liked pretending to be Italian.
Maybe it was because of that T-shirt Madonna wore in the Papa Don't Preach video that said, Italians do it better.
Do what better?
I don't know. It.
Jimmy said he'd been in the US since 1983, was well-educated, and had spent 8 years in the Italian Special Forces. He also wrote, I would like for you to know that I'm in prison. I have not been here long, not much time before I am released. I won't go into why I am in here in this letter, although it was nothing spectacular.
Yeah, just bashed my nana's head in with a rolling pin. Nothing special.
Sure, I choked and tried to rape a prison guard, but that's just normal everyday stuff.
I raped and killed an elderly special education teacher. Nothing to see here.
My prison buddy is Ted Bundy. You know, just normal guy things. Jimmy claimed to be an incurable romantic who loves to spend quiet evenings at home with a pretty lady.
Is that what he calls his cellmate blowjob buddy?
It's what he calls Ted Bundy.
Yeah, probably.
Kathy figured that with Florida being 3,000 miles away, what could it hurt to write back? She also gave him points for his honesty, even though clearly he wasn't being honest. In the third letter he sent Kathy, Jimmy explained to her why he came to be in prison. According to the book Dead of Night by John Lasseter, he said, well, I was stopped while driving one night. In a weird coincidence, my car looked identical to one that had just been used in a robbery, which is why the police stopped me. And then they found a large amount of marijuana in the glove compartment, and that's why I was arrested. He told her he was going to be getting his conviction expunged. In 1987, prison administrators decided Jimmy had served his full sentence for reasons. They considered the extra time he was given for infractions to be served concurrently with his original sentence, which makes no sense at all to me.
Yeah, so, like, what's the point of giving him extra time if he's not going
to
serve it?
All right, we sentence you to 10 years, but you can do it at home.
Yeah, pretty much. And work from home.
Yeah, and you can leave the house whenever you like.
Yeah, they knocked 4 years off how long he was supposed to be in there. 4 years. 4 years that he spent raping and killing people. Thank you.
On April 2nd, 1987, Jimmy was a free man. He wasn't even under parole board supervision. He was free to do whatever the fuck he wanted to, wherever the fuck he wanted to. Apart from owning a gun, that was the one thing he wasn't allowed to do. Due to his pen pal relationship with Kathy, he chose to head to Seattle, Washington. Around this time, he decided to change his name to Cesar Baroni. Hoping to distance himself from his criminal record, he claimed to his now girlfriend Kathy that Baroni was the name of the family who had raised him.
Did she wonder why he didn't have an Italian accent?
Well, apparently not, because they were married on October 27th.
Kathy, no!
And they moved in with her mum Joyce in Hillsborough, Oregon.
Kathy, no, don't let him near your mum!
Kathy transferred to her firm's Portland office and he found work as a cabinet maker. They saved up enough money for a deposit on their own house.
Jimmy bounced from job to job, then decided to join the army. He bullshitted his way through the interview, and they didn't clue onto the fact that he'd changed his name and had an extensive criminal record. In January 1989, he went to Fort Benning, Georgia, to complete basic training. You know that whole no guns thing when he got released from prison? Well, in the army, he became a sharpshooter.
Well, that's the opposite of no guns.
It really is. He got assigned to Fort Lewis, Washington, as a member of the 75th Ranger Regiment and got to wear a kiki beret.
Cool.
He and his unit were deployed to Panama in 1989.
That's where they make those hats.
It is. While there, he claimed to have killed 7 people. It's believed this was including civilians and women, but that can't actually be verified. While in Panama, he posted home a Browning 9mm pistol for Ron.
Oh, as in later Ron.
Mm-hmm. When he got home, one of Jimmy's dodgy friends, Carlos Romero, got him to keep his .22 revolver for him. So he ended up with 2 guns. After his return, Kathy became pregnant. She was thrilled. That is, until she got a call from the police. Kathy said, I received a phone call at work one day from a police officer saying that there'd been a complaint from an elderly woman. This woman said a man had been showing up at her house continuously and was scaring her. Jimmy had told the woman that he was with the Rangers and also told her he had a pregnant wife and the name of the company that Kathy worked for. With that information, the police tracked Kathy down to ask her some questions. They didn't tell her Jimmy had flashed an 80-year-old woman named Dora Vinson and tried to fondle her. Dora lived in an isolated area and had seen Jimmy lurking around near her place, apparently looking for something. When she asked him what he was looking for, he said that his wife's little white poodle had jumped out of the car window and ran off. He played up how upset his wife would be, so Dora helped him look for the imaginary poodle.
Here, precious. Where are you, girl?
Yeah, that was probably it. The next week, Jimmy darkened Dora's doorstep several times. He was insistent that she let him in her house for his visits. Now, during one of these, he tried to grope her breasts. She told him to stop, and he did. The next day, he came back again and insisted on showing Dora army techniques for edging forward while belly down on the floor. She humoured him, but was very anxious in his presence, especially after he grabbed her leg.
So, hang on, let me get this straight. He got into her house, grabbed her on the tit.
Well, that was one of the days, yes.
And then came back and showed her how to be prone and crawl under barbed wire. Now, that's the fucking weirdest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, he lay on the ground and did the, like, crawling forward wriggly thing. And he was like, this is how you do it.
And then he grabbed her leg. And she said, you know I can see you.
She probably wished she had some barbed wire.
Oh, I know.
Dora felt bad for this guy who she thought was a lonely soldier. But she told her son about him too, as she was very uncomfortable with the creepy attention he was giving her. Her son called the police and arranged for Dora to stay elsewhere with family.
Wise move.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, son. Thank you, Dora. Kathy couldn't believe what she was hearing about her husband and told the police there must be some mistake, which is what Jimmy told her when she asked him about it.
The police investigated Caesar Baroni and found that he used to be Adolf Rody and shared their findings with the army. They had a lot of egg on their faces for letting him through their screening process, and some shit hit some fans.
Not enough, in my opinion.
They gave him a general discharge on October 5th, 1990.
I think he deserved a worse kind of discharge.
Jimmy told Kathy it had nothing to do with groping Dora or lying about his identity, but was due to some discrepancy in his application. Jimmy didn't seem to care too much about leaving the army, but struggled to get another job, eventually going back to his old employer in cabinet making. This meant moving back to Hillsborough. That's in Oregon.
That's a fact, baby.
That's right. Kathy and Jimmy's son was born in January 1991, but this did nothing to cool his jets.
Yeah, or his jorts.
61-year-old Margaret Schmidt had lived in Hillsborough most of her life and had attended school there. She was described in the book Dead of Night as being dangerously overweight and crippled from having a broken leg several months earlier. So she's going through a hard time. She required a walker to help her get around. She frequented the community senior centre and told her friends she'd recently come into some money from selling antiques. Margaret was retired and used to work in a nursing home. She never married or had kids and lived alone with three cats.
That's what I want to be when I grow up.
You're nearly there, Tara.
Yeah, replace cats with dogs and give me two more, baby.
Margaret was security conscious and always locked her doors and windows. On the evening of April 18th, 1991, Margaret's friend Kathy Ackerman had come over to have dinner and catch up. She left at 7 p.m. At 10 a.m. the next morning, care worker Dorothy Baber stopped by Margaret's house, like she did three times every week to help her with her laundry and housekeeping. Margaret didn't answer the door when she knocked. Dorothy let herself in with a spare set of keys she'd been given. She approached Margaret's bedroom apprehensively. Once there, she saw Margaret lying naked on her back on the bed, one foot hanging limply off the side. Her face was covered with a blood-stained pillow and her body had been posed in the same way men who hate women always pose their dead bodies. In shock and horrified, Dorothy ran to the phone and called the police. When detectives searched Margaret's place, they observed that the porch light had been removed.
They also found a negative shoe print on the bathroom floor in spilled talcum powder. The footprints were men's size 8.5 and contained the word Reebok in capital letters. Detectives tracked down the exact make of the shoe, Reebok ERS 2000. This information was circulated and all police were to be on the lookout for the shoes while they went about their usual daily business. Detectives didn't make finding the Reebok print at the murder scene public for fear the killer would throw the shoes away. Smart. Margaret's autopsy revealed she died from asphyxiation by smothering and compression of the neck. She'd also been terribly sexually assaulted. No other leads were obtained except the shoes.
On the night of Thursday, October 8, 1992, 41-year-old nurse and midwife Martha Browning Bryant came into work to help with a difficult birth. The free-spirited Martha was one of the most requested birth coaches in Hillsborough and affectionately referred to her job as catching babies.
Well, they do come out pretty fast sometimes.
After Martha caught an 8-pound baby girl, she got ready to go home. She wanted to speak to her husband before he left for work that morning about a weekend trip to the Pacific beaches that they were planning. She jumped into a green 1966 VW bug that she'd named Willie and drove towards Portland. A short time later, at around 2:40 a.m, a car began tailgating her with their high beams on. There was pretty much no traffic on the road, nobody around, so it was even more unnecessary than usual. Then the car drove up next to her. With anxiety mounting, Martha hoped it was just teenagers being stupid, but her hopes were dashed when she heard a gunshot ring out. The driver of the other car had shot a bullet through the passenger side of the VW. The next shot exploded the passenger window inward, sending glass flying everywhere. He kept firing, eventually shooting Martha in the back under her left shoulder blade. The bullet went through one of her ribs, blasted a hole in her lung, and exited near her left armpit. Martha struggled to remain conscious and keep in control of the vehicle. The VW veered across two lanes, jumped the curb, and came to a halt on the footpath. The engine stalled, but the right indicator continued to blink. As Martha tried to catch her bearings, a man opened her car door and pulled her from the vehicle. That's where we're going to leave the case this week, but make sure you tune in next episode to hear the wild conclusion of the story of Bundy's buddy, serial killer Cesar Baroni.
Oh, really? That's fucked.
Yeah, I know. It seems mean, doesn't it? We could just do a 2.5-hour episode now if
you'd
like.
Yeah, I know, I know.
That's fucked.
I want to find out what happens.
Yeah, you know what? I know what happens, but I also want to find out what happens, if that makes any sense at all.
I have but one question for you.
Yes, Barney.
Tara, what is Aussie Az?
Aussie Az are tales of criminal stupidity and bloody legends with a quintessentially Australian flavour. Would you like to hear one?
Yes, I would.
According to ABC News, 61-year-old Northern Territory resident William Poynton recently called the police to his property in Tennant Creek to report a theft. He told the coppers that a young person had broken into his place and stolen something very important.
His spleen?
No.
His John Wayne Gacy painting of Pogo the Clown?
Double no.
Well, that's me all out of ideas.
The youths in question stole some of his precious marijuana plants.
File that under things you don't normally tell the cops.
I know, right? So after the police arrived, outraged Willie invited them to inspect his property. While doing so, police found and confiscated 69 cannabis plants. Some were as high as an elephant's eye, and so was Willie. He pleaded guilty in the Alice Springs Supreme Court earlier this week to cultivating a commercial quantity of cannabis. Now, why on earth would Willie call the cops on himself?
Maybe he's a self-loathing stoner.
I thought I'd cornered the market on that. Willie's lawyer, Noah Redman, told the court that while Willie reckoned cannabis shouldn't be illegal, he sternly believed that youths shouldn't smoke it. Reddo said, "The fact that he did call the police on himself for cultivating cannabis is a very significant factor. Youths were attempting to steal his cannabis, and he had a view that children are not capable of making decisions whether or not to smoke cannabis. So he called police to prevent them having access." Well, they'd already stolen it. so that doesn't really work. The court heard Willie had been growing weed for 4 decades, but he didn't sell it. He would, however, trade it for goods, foods and services, so he bartered it. Reddo still thought it was bloody important to drum home the point that his client had dobbed himself into the court. Willie will be sentenced later this week. Judge Peter Barr said,
"He must be given some credit for dobbing himself into police and for his motivation in doing so."
Now, like, that's cute and caring and everything, but I have an alternative theory as to what happened here.
Oh, well, come on then, spill it.
I reckon Willie might have been so stoned that he forgot weed was illegal. I mean, he was just behaving like any other person who thought youths had ripped him off and he called up the police.
Like they'd just stolen his lawnmower or something.
Yeah, exactly. I reckon it's only when he saw the reactions of the cops while they were looking at his wacky tobacco plants that he realised what he'd done. I mean, come on, who is going to call the cops to come look at their crop? He's been growing weed for 40 years without getting caught, as if this is the first time a youth has nicked one of his plants. Come on. Look, this is just a theory, mind you. So don't stick your sausage dog lawyer onto me, Willie.
Don't stick your sausage dog lawyer onto me, Willie.
Well, it's good advice.
Well, I mean, it is good advice.
You don't want that either, do
well,
you?
Well, I've got one thing to say about that, and I say free Willie.
Free Willy. Yeah. Oh, this story is in like so many different like newspapers and websites and stuff, and no one's questioning it either, but I've just got my suspicions. I just reckon it doesn't add up.
Nah, it doesn't really, does it? Oh, well, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny. Free Willy. Don't put the sausage dog lawyer on me, Willy. So this brings us to the end of the episode.
But before we go, we'd like to thank some people who took the time to write us some good reviews.
So thank you to Nomujlu from the United States.
We've got Addicted to Jay from United Kingdom.
Annalise79 from Australia.
And Tracker PI, which I'm pretty sure is Nick, Jenny Sue's dad.
Yeah. Hey,
Nick. Keep on tracking. He's in the United States.
We'd also like to thank Lorraine and our Facebook moderating team.
You know who else is awesome?
Who?
Me.
No.
And our patrons.
Yes.
We love them. We love them so much we've been holding monthly giveaways.
For our June prize, we're giving away a Hey Baby pack consisting of a T-shirt, face mask and badge.
For a chance to win, be a Bloody Murder patron at a level $5 or above. Now, you know how we have lots of different levels of patronship. Each different level gets lots of benefits, like different kinds of merch. So look it up.
Look it up.
Look it up. It's on our website.
It certainly is.
Now, we've had a bunch of new bloody legends join our Patreon program. So thank you to Laura King.
Micah. Ooh, she's a prosecutor.
Jennifer Rigby.
And Mandy Hockey.
We'd also like to thank Matt Stapleton, who upped his pledge.
Yeah, I think he upped his pledge when he realised we were mates with Jason Abercrombie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like, are you the Jason Abercrombie? Cambo talks about.
They're all having 4Xs together, aren't they?
Yeah, which sounds good.
They're all drinking the toilet beer.
Toilet wine.
If you would like to support us, visit our website, or if you just want to buy us a drink. That's my thirsty voice. There's a PayPal donate button there too.
And who's buying the drinks this week, Barney?
Well, the most lovely Tina Cagle. Thanks so much, Tina.
Thank you, Miss Cagle.
I've been Barney Black.
And I've been Tara Saraband.
And this is Bloody Murder. Please don't forget to review us on Apple Podcast or on our Facebook page. Now, you don't need to write a well-crafted essay, just 5 stars and, hey, baby, keep kicking against the pricks, something like that. That still counts.
Yeah, it would. And, of course, rate and subscribe. It really helps us synergize backward overflow and increase our iconic listener fundamentals.
Just as you talk some shit sometimes.
I know. Follow us through our Facebook page or join our Facebook group. On Twitter, we're at Bloody Murder Pod, and Insta, we're Bloody_Murder_Podcast.
Check out our website, bloodymurderpodcast.com, for news, galleries, more episodes, and links to our fabulous threadless merchandise.
Thanks for sticking around, and we'll be back soon.
Goodbye and adios.
And keep kicking against the pricks. I make a valid point.
What point was that?
That you should keep kicking against the pricks. Kick those pricks, sore sad dicks.
Wow, it writes itself, doesn't it?
Kick those pricks, make them sore sad dicks. Don't be jealous of my boogie. It's been so cold when I've walked the dog in the morning lately. and also really bright and sunny, that my sunglasses keep fogging up. It's really annoying.
Wow. First world problems, eh?
Yeah, I'm like deserving of all the sympathy. You already gave up. You're like, this is over, Tara. Don't even try. Don't even try to make something happen. I'm done.
That's
Barney,
right.
Barney out.
Barney out.
December 4th, 1960 was not a very auspicious day, aside from being Scottish comedian Ronnie Corbett's 30th birthday.
Well, that's very auspicious.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a big day for Ronnie and the Corbett family. They had a huge party.
I heard that they had 7 piñatas and each one was as big as Ronnie Corbett.
So we could fit all of them in our pockets?
Easily.
They served cocktails in baby bottles and started the evening feeding the guests various purees on spoons.
Well, I heard, Tara, they had a conjoined twin erotic dancers and a gigantic turtle that tried to eat Ronnie's mother.
She had to beat it off with her handbag.
It's okay, the turtle was into it.
Then you greened out and fell asleep on the couch, didn't you, Barney?
It was only for 20 minutes and I could hear you all smack-talking me.
We were just doing that to see if you were asleep and because we hate you.
Oh, it's not very nice. I was back. I could hear everything you were saying. Oh, that Barney's too handsome. He's too talented.
He is a sexy motherfucker. Oh. And we're going to, you know... We're just going to have to objectify you a little bit more with our eyes. That's what we were saying.
That's right. You're just looking at my mustache and my eyes are here, all right?
Yeah, I know. My eyes are up here. See, it works for you too, doesn't
That's
it?
That's right. When he became a teenager, Jimmy... Oh, I've got a fucking itchy nose.
Ah, oh, you should get really cross about it, huh?
Oh, why is it?
I don't know. Oh, hey, by the way, I haven't been furious about the YouTube ads lately.
Well, that's good. Your anger management. You're dealing with
well,
it.
Well, I think I expressed myself and then it's sort of like it's calmed down. It's gone away.
Hey, you know what you could do? You could just put an ad blocker on and they wouldn't even play.
Yeah, but that sounds hard. How do I do that? Why didn't you tell me this when I told you about how upset they made me? Well, how much they made me swear and like be like, I'm going to kill everyone you love.
Because I really enjoyed that. I thought that was okay, pretty goddamn cool. Obvious.
Well, I'm glad that we've just clarified that.
Did you once tell me that Barney's a stupid name and it's the name of a smoking monkey?
I did tell you that it was the name a smoking monkey would have, yes. I probably wouldn't have said it was a stupid name. That's a bit straightforward for me. I would have been like, Barney, that's the kind of name that someone who likes going to a rodeo would give their pet smoking monkey.
Yeah, actually, I'm getting you mixed up with my girlfriend. When I first met her, she said, Barney, what kind of stupid name is that?
Oh, and you were... Well, see, this is how much you love being insulted. You were like, woo, come hither, baby.
Oh, wow, God.
Woo, way to put some wood in my undies.
That's right.
I'm just... Tell me more things that are shit about me. I'm listening, baby. I'm listening.
I am. Come on, bring it on.
It's episode 159. I think it might have almost run out by now.
Well, you can make some up.
Oh, I don't think I need to. There's still some areas I haven't mined yet.
Well, there you go.
I don't know. Maybe yeah. You should be mean to me instead.
Just get stuck into that shit mine and see what you can dig up.
It's so stinky down there. I don't like going.
Well, you have to.
He was about 5'10", with a medium build and short brown hair, with highlights on the top.
Oh, lordy, he had frosted tips?
At certain times, yes. But that's actually probably the best thing about him.
Well, you know, I had frosted tips when I was a teenager.
Oh, really? For how long?
For about a year. And I had this one outfit that I was really happy with. It was these acid wash jeans, light-coloured acid wash jeans.
Oh, yeah.
And acid-
were they tight?
Oh, yeah, that was tight.
Oh, yeah, like glad wrap tight.
Oh, you could see what I had for breakfast.
Yeah,
thank
for sure. You. You could see what year the 20-cent piece in your pocket was made.
That's right. That was all the money I had. And and I had an acid wash jacket as well that matched
cool.
it.
Cool.
And I had this apricot grandpa shirt that I used to unbutton to leave a few
What's
chest
a grandpa
hairs.
Shirt?
It's just got buttons on the top.
Oh,
that
okay,
down,
yeah.
You know, like about 4 inches.
Yeah, so it's just like a T-shirt with a few buttons on it.
Yeah.
And you used to unbutton them to show them what probably your not hairy chest back then.
Oh, no. I had a hairy chest when I was about 5.
3.
Yeah. All right. It was 9. We're exaggerating. Anyway, I'd walk down the street and I was just thinking, I look fantastic.
You would have been strutting.
I was strutting. I was concentrating on trucking, right?
Uh-huh.
And I thought all the girls are going to come up to me, but I'm sure they were just intimidated by my wispy teenage mustache and my awesome outfit.
They were jealous of your boogie. They wanted to approach you, but they didn't know how.
That's right.
So did you frost the tips yourself, or like how did you make that happen?
I went to a hairdresser's, of course.
Yeah, well, when you're a kid with only 20 cents, you can't always afford to go to a hairdresser.
Well, no, maybe my mum paid for it.
I actually put Ajax on my head at around that age because I wanted my hair to go blonde and I didn't have anything else to
Ajax.
Use. It had bleach in it.
Yeah, well, at least you didn't eat it.
No, I didn't eat it, but I think it might have seeped into my brain.
Ah, that never explains a few things, doesn't it?
Never been the same.
Yeah.
It did make it a bit lighter. And then all of my lovely friends at school, of which I had none, said, "That's stupid. Why don't you dye your hair the colour it was, you stupid fat bitch?"
Well, that's nasty.
That was the nicest thing anyone said.
In April 1977, Detective Robert Williams of the Flort.
Flort is a nice word.
Flort is a good word.
Oh, I'm flaunting it.
It's when I'm flaunting.
Yeah, would you like to come flaunting?
It's when I'm flirting in my jorts.
Yeah.
I'm flaunting.
Oh, baby. Oh, the temperature just went up.
That's right.
Oh, anyone else sweating a little bit? Jort flirting.
Oh, Barney, is it hot in here?
Or is it just your florts?
Is it just flaunting? Are you flaunting with me, Barney? Well, I am wearing my jorts.
Excuse me, Mr. Black. Are you flaunting with me? Are you flaunting with me, Mr. Barney Black, if that is your real name?
I can't help it if my jorts are just going to rock your world.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm just thinking that the room was all on fire. My microphone's hairy. You're welcome.
Is that what you call it?
I don't know, Barney. Say check 1, 2 into it and see what happens.
I think I'll probably get a punch in the face, right?
Not just one.
And not just one face.
No, not just one anything. No. I'd be putting my cigarettes out on your eyeballs, friend.
Hey, Barney's eyeballs aren't ashtrays.
Well, perhaps they are. If he says check 1, 2 into my microphone, my hairy microphone. Oh, God.
Oh, you started all of this.
I didn't. There was literally a fucking hair on the microphone. I was being literal.
What kind of hair was it? I mean, how long was it? What colour, etc.?
It's hard to tell because it's kind of dark. I don't know. I decided I should move on.
Well, I'm staying.
I'm going to put it behind me.
This is where I live now. I'm not moving anywhere.
That's how I felt when I was waiting for ages at the delicatessen window today. I thought you were going to come up at some point, but instead you just went and sat in the car. But I was going to go to you. This is my life now.
I sat in the car, opened the sunroof and turned up Gloria by Laura Branigan and sang away.
Yeah, I came back to a real rockin' party. I was just like, wow, you're this guy, are you?
Yeah, I'm that guy. I'm thinking about buying some roller skates next week. It's a lycra.
I got a feeling that next summer those little jorts of yours are going to get chopped up even higher. I think this is the direction we're heading in.
My mustache is up here. He had just turned 17 and he had a banging party with his monkey.
Yeah, Adolf Jr. and him danced to Gloria by
Laura Branigan.
Laura Branigan. And then they danced to Laura by Gloria Estefan.
Really?
I don't think that's a real song.
And Dr. Beat by Miami Sound Machine.
You know what was popular in this era? Because I had a look into it. A lot of Milli Vanilli and Bobby Brown. A lot of it.
Yeah, right.
Yep. Bit of Paula Abdul.
Well, you know, she had some banging tunes. Can't remember any of their names, but...
Straight up now, tell me, are you going to love my monkey forever?
Is that a real song? Or did you just make that up?
Part of it's real.
Yeah.
She doesn't mention monkeys at all. That's the problem with Paula Abdul's music. Not enough monkey references.
Jimmy was transported to the Indian River Correctional Institution north of Fort Lauderdale.
North of Jorts Lauderdale.
Jorts Lauderdale.
That's my drag king name. Hi, I'm Jorts Lauderdale.
Jorts Lauderdale, Florida detective.
Oh, I think maybe a private eye. Used to be a detective. Yeah. Private eye with a drinking problem. Yeah. Jorts Lauderdale.
Jorts Lauderdale, PI.
I'm very good at solving other people's cases and problems, but you know what? I'm just clueless when it comes to my own. If only I could meet a sexy, pretty lady who I could trust with all my feelings.
I love kicking in doors and taking photos of people having sex in hotel rooms.
I like kissing ladies and writing down number plates.
Is that your job? Is that your job, George Lauderdale? No, I just like doing that.
That's my hobby, baby. Do you think he knows Pug Detective?
Now with crossover episode with Pug Detective.
Short slaughtered LPI. I've got to add that to my list. After Pug Detective, that's what we can do. Short
slaughtered. Jimmy was transported to the Indian River Correctional Institution north of Fort Lauderdale. Come on, I got that out.
I know you did, I'm sorry.
Now I've got to do it again.
I'm sorry, am I boring you? Did you just do a big yawn?
Yeah.
You just tune out when you're not talking, don't you?
No. Just...
I don't really care.
I was thinking about sausage dogs and I got sleepy.
Yeah. Hey, Ted, who's your favourite character from the TV show MASH? You don't watch it? Yeah, me either. It's really dumb.
Surely it'd be Klinger. Hot Lips.
I'm not going to say Frank. Hawkeye, I guess.
Frank, Ferret Face.
Trapper. BJ. They never gave him shit for being called BJ. Did you notice that?
I know.
Did you ever see the movie version of MASH?
Yeah, it's boring.
It's not just boring. It's heinously sexist. They just sexually harass Hot Lips Houlihan the whole time. By the way, the TV show's not far behind. But they actually just sexually harass her all the time to the point of, like, near attacks. And when she's showering one day, they just, like, take the shower thing off so she's naked in front of it. It was just really, like, what the fuck?
But right in the middle of it, there's about a 60-minute scene of a football game, which is one of the most boring things I've ever seen.
I don't know what Robert Altman was on back then. Yeah. Is that him? I think it was him.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, no. Klinger. Is that who you said first?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I think you've got a point there. I still love Radar, though. I can't help it.
Really?
Yeah, kind of.
It's that big mole on his forehead, isn't it?
It's the fact that he's missing fingers, and that's why he's always carrying a clipboard. You never see him without something in his hand, because they're always trying to, like, disguise the fact that he has some missing fingers.
I noticed you didn't say Father Mulcahy, because no one likes him.
No one does like Father Mulcahy, except when he plays the piano.
Oh, yeah, then he's very popular.
Yeah. Yeah. Hot Lips. She was pretty... She reminded me of Miss Piggy a little bit.
She's a brassy broad.
I do like brassy broads, but she was also a bit of a stickler for the rules. And, like, I'm a bit like Pug Detective. Like, I'm not a stickler for the rules.
Not in the later episodes. Can we talk about MASH more?
No. I would rather we didn't.
I think I'm going to just talk like this all the time now.
Seriously. Yeah, just like that and then mix it up with a bit of no.
No.
And I'm just going to speak like business, Tara, and sometimes like a complete and utter wanker. I think we're set.
I like how we're both trying to change each other's personalities because we hate each other, clearly.
Yeah, duh. Doesn't take a Pug Detective or George Lauderdale to figure that out.
Well, no.
She jumped into a green 1966 VW Bug that she'd named Willy and drove towards Portland.
Well, that's weird because I call my Willy VW Bug.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, fuck me. I was going to say they're about the same size, but that car's like a bug is small, but a car is big.
Oh, yeah. Just stick it somewhere in the middle.
They had the intercom on in the room. And they kept lying that it wasn't on, and they were using sonic pressure on my head since 1997.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.